Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com.
Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. Well, it was a long time coming, but here is the first episode of a two-part story from the author of The Genesis Machine, Echoes of an Alien Sky, and Code of the Life Maker. It's a tale of action and suspense in the titanium age. Variant Frequencies is proud to present for the first time in audio form an early adventure of James P. Hogan's most endearing hero. Join us as we welcome one of science fiction's most visionary names to the podosphere with Jailhouse Rock by James P. Hogan. We have gathered another fantastic cast for this story. Our cast includes Will Hoffecker, Phil Rossi, Jan Dalton, Jack Ward, Lonnie Ezell, Kieran O'Carroll, Neil Stringer, and Nobilis. Oh, and me as the narrator. We want to thank all of these very talented people for sharing their voices with us. Now, on to our story. High above the stormy southern hemisphere of Mars, a routine cargo transport has turned into a high-stakes standoff between Skyguard soldiers and vicious mercenaries turned thieves. They call him Knight. But Kieran Thane is just a rookie trooper who's been taken along for the ride. Now, unarmed and faced with a treacherous crew and ruthless interstellar hijackers, Kieran has only a few hours to spoil their plans and live up to his name. Jailhouse Rock by James P. Hogan. It was storm season in the southern hemisphere of Mars. Above the turbid orange clouds obscuring the western parts of Hellas Planitia and the region toward the equator, the Mocha freighter flew on a heading north of west. 1,000 yards behind, the Skyguard's escort gunship that was accompanying it to Lowell Base, still a quarter of the planet away, maintained station slightly above and to starboard. Unseen satellites passing high overhead sent periodic updates on the vessel's progress to a monitoring program running in the computers at Skyguard's headquarters, located at Lowell. As flying machines went, the Mocha was ugly and ungainly, a boxy open-frame center body designed to hold a variety of cargo modules, an independently maneuverable crew module in front, one from a selection of propulsion modules attached behind, and on the sides, either high-lift wings for atmospheric duty or boosters capable of low-orbit injection to connect with the satellite transfer stations. But it was well-suited to its role of hauling miscellaneous loads around the newly opening-up planet. Its name derived from the official designation of Modular Cargo Handler. Naturally, everybody called them Mocha ships. At the rear of the flight deck and the crew module, rookie recruit trooper Kieran Thane sat cramped on a folding jump seat between the rear bulkhead systems panel and an equipment rack, one arm resting on a run of power cables crossing the wall ribs, a close-quarters autocarbine wedged next to his leg beneath. The vessel was owned and operated by a general carrier at Zerlon Base on the far side of Mars from Lowell, that styled itself grandly Haulers of Fame and was carrying a cargo of space weaponry and programmable munitions that would fetch premium bid prices among the various mercenary forces, commercial rivalries, and other squabbling enterprises taking form among the belt habitats and beyond if it happened to go astray. Hence, the armed escort ship. Kieran had been put aboard the Mocha as linkman between its crew and the escort commander, as routine required. The vessel was built to minimal surface utility standards, which meant that everyone was wearing EV suits, with helmets close by, ready at hand.
Escort leader calling Mocha.
The voice of Lieutenant Combs sounded in Kieran's phones.
Acknowledge and report.
Roger. Everything's normal here.
Kieran responded over the circuit.
I hear you. Out.
The three-man crew's captain, who was called Ursark, and occupied the SECOM station on the far side of the nav display table, looked at Kieran with a mixture of cynicism and amusement.
Right on time again. That's a regulation scrub toy soldier you got there, kid. Does he come with a key sticking out of his back, or batteries?
I guess everyone does things the right way until they get to know where they can cut corners.
Was all Kieran could think of to say in reply.
Well, I'm sure glad it's not me who stands to get shot while he's learning.
Ursark drawled. He seemed to be trying to goad. Kieran wasn't sure why. Probably just part of his nature. Kieran didn't respond, but kept his eyes on the windshield in front of the other two crewmen, and watched the slowly creeping vista of whipped cotton candy, stirred by descending canyons of clearer air. Occasional upthrusts of rock loomed as shadows, sometimes breaking through into the sunlight like yellow-brown icebergs riding in an ocean of orange foam. Ursark was swarthy-skinned and fleshy in build, with oily black hair, several days' growth of stubble, and a barking laugh that revealed strong teeth while asserting disdain and defiance. His eyes were black and depthless, betraying nothing of what might be taking place within. But Kieran conceded inwardly that he had a point in his own artless way. The troopers dubbed the commanding lieutenant Thumper Combs. Everything was undeviatingly as ordained and stipulated in the book, but at least they didn't have to take orders from somebody learning in a combat mission situation. Kieran reflected. That would have been a lot worse. He rested his head back against the painted metal bulkhead and idly surveyed the other two crew. Bolin, doing the piloting, was lean and muscular with somewhat drawn features and short reddish hair. He seemed to go about his work easily and competently. Kieran wondered what other tempting offers there might be for somebody like him out here, as opposed to working for the regular carriers or other agencies that employed pilots. Demand was said to be such that they could virtually name their own pay. Maybe the added kick of mixing a little danger with wasn't something that appealed to everyone. In the engineer's station next to Bolin was Wallachs, black-haired, square-chinned, and rugged face. He had said little, allowing Kieran to form no clear impression of him, although there had been a hint of an aggressive streak. Somehow, the three didn't fit the image that Kieran would have guessed for an off-world flight crew. But then, what experience did he have to guide him as to what should be expected in these distant places where humankind was finding new homes? As the freighter droned on above the wilderness, his thoughts drifted to the wider picture that he found himself part of. Although still officially a base, Lowell was creeping outward along the canyon bottoms from an intersection of canyons in the complex of Vales Marineris, merging its original dome structures between new roofs spanning between the walls to become already an incipient city. Earth had rebounded from its century of institutionalized technophobia, and with the advent of fusion, strong force catalysts, and other nuclear technologies that had revolutionized just about everything from space transportation to materials extraction and processing. Humanity was finally bursting from its home world to pick up again at what should have been the next step back in the years when the Apollo monuments were left on the moon. Mars was opening up. The belt worlds, natural and artificial, we're seeing the beginnings of what some predicted would become a dizzying diversity of cultures and lifestyles. A few adventurous souls had established what looked like being a permanent human presence among the moons of the gas giants, amid all the vitality, restlessness, innovation, and inevitably rivalries and differences. Comfortable Terran notions of a common system of enforceable law had been left behind. Some said it would follow eventually. Others maintained it was already a dead concept, and some new system for restraining excesses and dispensing justice would have to be invented. In the meantime, there was plenty of work for go-it-alone operators like Sky Guards, protecting life and property, and were expedient or arguably justifiable, generally helping to promote interests. The Mocha's engine note changed suddenly to a succession of juddering coughs, bringing Kieran back from his musings. The craft dipped and banked to a port, throwing him forward from the seat and causing him to grab at a side bracing. An alarm note wailed as the pilot's panel lit up with red indicators. Outside, the horizon of cloud tilted and swam sideways across the windshield. Boland slammed the controls to manual and threw a worried look back at Ursark.
What is it?
Ursark barked.
Major thrust loss. Synchronizer failure. Double X category malfunction.
The power system's screwed. We gotta go down.
Wallach shouted.
Escort leader to Mocha Rider. You're altering course and altitude. What's happening?
Some kind of power failure, sir. The engineer says they have to put down.
Hell, we're not asking for permission.
Bolin yelled over his shoulder as he wrestled with the manual
30,000
stick.
Feet.
And Wallach called numbers and flipped switches.
We're down to 20,000.
Whatever he thinks doesn't come into this.
The Mocha nosed into a descent.
10,000 feet.
Then
dropping.
Angled back to use its braking thrusters, the main power note
6,000 feet.
Steadying but falling. Orange haze enveloped it, becoming denser, streaking 4, past the windshield and ports to give a sudden hint of the craft's velocity.
3,000
Bolin
feet.
Watched the forward radar imager and centered on 2,000 what looked
feet.
Like a straight run of reasonably 1, flat terrain ahead, clear of obstructions and boulders, flanked by rocky bluffs on both sides.
That's our only chance,
he yelled to Ursark.
Go for it,
Ursark told him. Kieran spoke into the stem mic on his suit collar.
Looks like a genuine emergency, sir. We're out of options here. Trying for a clear strip dead ahead at... What's the range of that?
5 miles.
5 miles.
We're following you down. Tell the captain that I'm calling Lowell for an emergency pickup.
Kieran passed on the message and braced a foot against one of the metal steps coming up from the doorway behind, which led back to the access section, where the suiting chamber and the airlock were located. A hazy colored version of the radar image appeared dimly beyond the windshield, growing larger, flattening out, and then expanding to meet them as the Mocha came down. Additional dust blown up by the retros blotted out what view there was of the final few seconds before the skid struck with a jolt and a brief shriek of metal racing over frozen sand and rubble. The craft went up on a bounce, grounded again, and eventually scraped its way to a halt. As the dust thinned outside the windows and on the viewscreen, Ursark cut to a rearward shot showing the escort ship landing through the storm, maybe 100 yards back. The Mocha's engines died, and the hiss of sand blowing over the outside hull became audible for the first time. Ursark looked across at Kieran. He was showing his teeth, smiling in a strangely satisfied way that wasn't consistent with the situation. Kieran returned a puzzled look and was about to speak, when Wallach produced a pistol and leveled it at him. Kieran shook his head uncomprehendingly.
What?
Not a word, kid.
Ursark's voice was cool, but menacing. He leaned over the nav display table and reached across to tear the mic from Kieran's suit collar. Then he indicated the auto carbine by Kieran's leg and motioned with a hand for Kieran to hand it over.
Slow and easy. But first, okay? Nobody has to get hurt.
Bolin was calling from the pilot's console.
Hello, Sandman. Do you read? Are you out there?
A voice answered, patching through the cabin speaker.
I hear you, Bird. You're a few hundred yards past the marker. We're on our way.
Gotcha.
Combs came through in Kieran's ear.
Escort leader to Mocha Rider. Report situation.
But Kieran had no means of reply.
Come in, Rider.
Kieran lifted his weapon clear from the wall, reversed it, and set it in Urshark's waiting hand.
What's going on?
He demanded.
Wait.
Ursark answered, and stared expectantly at his viewscreen, still showing the shape of the gunship nose on, standing in the murk. Wallach kept Kieran covered. Kieran followed Urshark's gaze. At the pilot's console, Bolin operated some switches. An electric whine came from the rear, which Kieran recognized as the sound of the loading door of the cargo module opening. Maybe 10 seconds passed by. And then a quick series of flashes lit up seemingly behind the gunship, which lurched visibly, accompanied by the crump, crump, crump of weapon fire sounding deceptively distant in the thin atmosphere. A window opened on the screen to present a side view of the gunship, evidently coming from an external source, that showed the rear end of its fuselage torn and holed, its tail surfaces shredded. Then another burst of tracer streamed from a point near the camera and raked the stern engine pod. The damage was localized away from the personnel compartment, which was farther forward, Kieran could see. But the gunship wasn't going anywhere. It had been reduced to little more than a life support shelter in the desert. Combs hadn't fully grasped the situation.
Mocha crew, alert. We are being attacked. Secure...
But a new voice cut him off, sounding on a channel evidently directed at the gunship, but which Bolin or Wallachs had patched to the speaker circuit.
Calling you Skyguards, turkeys. Can you hear me in there?
Combs replied.
I hear you. What is...
Your bean can is immobilized and covered by heavy infantry weapons.
Which meant ordnance capable of taking the gunship apart at that range.
Sit tight, and this can be easy on everyone. You're not calling any shots. And let's not forget that we still have one of your people in the freighter.
The viewpoint that the image was coming from began moving forward past the nose of the stranded gunship, and then ahead of it. Moments later, a smaller, approaching blur appeared on the screen showing the view sternward, and transformed into a general-purpose desert crawler, used all over Mars for survey work, exploration, and scientific expeditions. It halted just short of the Mocha, and two figures clad in heavy-grade EV suits and helmets got out. They crossed through the sand spray toward the Mocha and disappeared from the viewing angle. Bolin switched to a camera showing the inside of the cargo module with its loading door open, and the two figures just coming in off the ramp. The voice that had spoken before announced,
Okay, we're in.
We've got you, Sandman.
Then let's move it.
Bolin closed the loading door. The engine started again, rose in volume, and Kieran felt the craft moving.
Escort leader to Mocha Rider. Our position appears to be compromised. Unknown hostile elements are approaching you and are heavily equipped. If you are receiving this, offer no resistance. Repeat, do not resist.
Ursark flexed his console mic in Kieran's direction and gestured toward it, at the same time leering derisively. Despite himself, Kieran felt his face flush with embarrassment at his own helplessness.
Yes, sir,
he acknowledged self-consciously.
That's a good soldier.
The voice that Ursark had addressed as Sandman came over the speaker again.
Calling the bean can. Just to let you know, we've left a functioning crawler about 100 yards in front of you. It'll get you by until help shows up if your support system's shot. Bye, turkeys.
The Mocha bumped its way up to speed, lifted off, and rose into the storm, by then growing darker with the first shades of evening. Since there was no internal access forward, the two additional hijackers, for it was obvious that the whole thing had been a setup, remained in the cargo module. No doubt Combs had already put out a distress call and reported the incident, but provided the Mocha relied on its navigation aids and stayed below the ceiling of the storm blanketing the region, the satellites would have little chance of finding it optically or on infrared, and naturally, the tracking signal being transmitted previously would have been switched off. Since its course was unknown, the area that it might be in increased with the square of the distance covered as time went by. 1,000 miles of flying would generate over 3 million square miles to get lost in, and plenty of time for it to switch the cargo to a different vehicle, or whatever else the hijackers had planned. Ursark's manner mellowed somewhat, now that the critical point was passed. He produced a flask and some plastic mugs, poured out 3 coffees, and passed 2 forward, along with a couple of film-wrapped sandwiches and a bag of chips, and then looked quizzically at Kieran, as if in an afterthought.
Eat?
He invited. Kieran had no idea how long it might be before another opportunity might present itself. In any case, he was getting hungry. He nodded.
Sure. Thanks.
Ersark filled another mug and pushed it across the nav table, following it with another sandwich. He unwrapped one for himself and began munching, at the same time watching Kieran curiously.
You know, you're not so bad, kid. You keep it cool, you know what I mean? Not the kind that loses his head and acts stupid. Somebody like you could do okay if you had connections.
He smacked his lips noisily and worked something from his teeth with his tongue.
Any idea what you could make working for the right people?
He studied the expression on Kieran's face. Firm, not looking for a fight, but refusing to concede or be drawn into anything either.
Still pumped up with principles and ideology, eh?
Give him another 10 years.
Boland said without taking his eyes off the dust veils whipping by outside.
I used to fly for one of those enforcer outfits too, once.
I never knew that...
Ersark seemed about to say something more when Sandman spoke from the cargo module.
Hey, Urs.
What?
I don't think we're gonna have enough air here to last all the way to Quintus.
Ersark's eyes flickered alarm in Kieran's direction.
Watch your talk,
he said into the mic.
All right. But we need to put down somewhere along the way and get fresh bottles from the cab.
Ersark turned his head in Bolin's direction.
Did you hear that? Can do?
Bolin was already keying in a query to change the flight plan. A revised course appeared on a terrain map showing on one of his screens, and a string of numbers rolled across the bottom.
There's a hard pad. We can put down at 40 minutes from here,
he announced.
Increases final ETA by less than half an hour. We should be okay.
40 minutes from now,
Ersark relayed back.
Reckon you can hold out till then?
Yep. Shouldn't be a problem.
Quintus, if Kieran remembered correctly, was a mesa-like geographical feature somewhere near the edge of the deserts of Elysium. Night had fallen by the time the Mocha set down. The flight deck screens and the view through the windshield showed the surroundings to be in a flat depression fringed by a rock scarp. Possible a crater rim. Appearing as disconnected crests and edges, picked out against shadow by starlight filtering down through the still dusty air. But they seemed to be out of the storm. Kieran made out structures of some kind outlined dimly a short distance away. A construction gantry, maybe, and several storage sheds. Moving awkwardly in his suit in the confines of the cabin, Ersark went back into the access section, taking his helmet. From the doorway behind where he was sitting, Kieran heard the clatter and clinking of bottles being taken from a rack, sounds of Ersark securing his helmet, and finally a suit monitor's triple beep confirming systems to be functioning normally. Then came the whir of the inner lock door opening, Ersark shuffling through, and the lock closing again. In the flight deck compartment, Wallach studied his fingers between glancing at Kieran, his pistol still close at hand. Bolin opened the cargo module door and reactivated the view of the inside to show Sandman and his companion moving out onto the ramp to stretch cramped arms and legs in the light that had come on within.
Any coffee left back there?
Bolin asked. Wallach passed him the flask. Bolin refilled his mug and returned to contemplating the scene outside, immersed in thoughts of his own. Something was odd, Kieran realized. Why would Ersark have bothered putting on his helmet and going outside to take the bottles back, when Sandman and the other with him were already fully suited? Ersark could simply have left the bottles in the lock chamber to be retrieved from the outside. The answer came when Ersark appeared in the view on the screen, and while Sandman and his companion took turns attaching the replacement bottles to each other's packs, entered into an animated discussion with them over another channel. This time not switched through to the cabin. They wanted to have a private conversation. And then, when Kieran had been watching with more or less detached interest for perhaps a minute, it suddenly hit him what it was they needed to talk privately about. After Sandman's careless talk earlier in which he had let slip their destination, the problem was what to do with him, with Kieran. And now, guessing the subject of the debate, he was virtually able to follow the exchange from the gestures and body language, even in suits. Sandman. Somehow Kieran knew which was Sandman. Arms spread, hands upturned. Then a one-handed throwing away motion, followed by hands crossed, opening to make a breaststroke movement. What's your problem, Urs? He knows too much. Get rid of him. It's simple. Then the whole thing's behind us. Clean and over. Ursark. Two palms restraining gesture. Window wiping movement. Side to side shoulder swings, emphasizing shaking of the head. Finally, both hands turned up in appeal. Wait a minute. Think about it. That's a whole different rap than for a heist if things screw up. I didn't agree to that kind of ride. He's just a kid, for Christ's sakes. Sandman's companion. Half turn away. Pause. Turn back. One arm sowing seed. Either way, I don't care. Can we just get this settled? We're wasting time. The chilling realization came home to Kieran that they were arguing over his life. Wallach's idle toying with the pistol, and Boland's studied detachment took on a whole new, sinister significance. He felt his mouth and throat turning dry. He was the kind who knew how to keep cool, Ursark had said. Not one to lose his head. Yeah, right. Not losing your head could come fairly naturally when you had no choices to make. Then Ursark's voice sounded over the cabin speaker.
Calling the kit soldier. Get helmeted up and move your ass out here, okay?
Kieran stared around dazedly, trying to tell himself this couldn't be happening. He'd signed up for a tour away from Earth on what sounded like an exciting job. That was all. It wasn't supposed to end like this. And so soon. He looked at the others in a silent, desperate plea. Boland continued staring implacably through the windshield. Wallach cradled the pistol more securely in his palm and looked up.
I guess that means you,
he said laconically. And for an insane moment, Kieran tried estimating distances by eye with thoughts of trying to grab for it. But it was pointless. He got up numbly from the jump seat and picked up his helmet from the ledge where he had set it.
I'm not hearing an answer,
Ursark's voice said from the speaker.
He is on his way,
Wallach replied. Moving mechanically, as if someone else had taken control, Kieran went down the steel steps to the access section, initiated the lock cycle, and donned his helmet while the lock was filling. When the indicator changed to green, he entered, heard the inner door close behind, and waited for the chamber to exhaust, refill with Martian air, and for the pressures to balance. The outer door slid aside, and the conveyor step carried him down 6 feet to the surface, his dreamlike sensation enhanced by the 38% Earth normal gravity. He walked back toward the open cargo door. Ursark was waiting at the bottom of the ramp. Further back, the other two were maneuvering something down from its stowage space between the center body frame and the propulsion module. Kieran saw that it was the vessel's scooter, an open, two-person electric runabout carried by most larger craft for extending the range of surface activities. On occasions, they had also proved their worth as lifeboats. While Sandman and the other proceeded to strip the radio and emergency beacon from the scooter's electronics box, Ursark filled Kieran in.
Okay, so this is the deal. There's a triple S on a bearing of 240 degrees from here that you should be able to make in 4 to 5 hours. You've got extra air and water under the seat. We can't leave you with a live transmitter, but there's a homer that'll give you a fix when you get close enough. Just hope you don't hit problems. I know the chances aren't perfect, but they're the only ones you've got.
Surface survival shelters containing food, life support gear, medical kits, and other essentials usually located at radio navigation beacons were dotted all over Mars for use in emergencies. Mars had no magnetic field. The electronic compasses worked off the satellite grid. Kieran opened his mouth behind his helmet visor to say something, but Ursark cut him off with a wave.
There's nothing to discuss. That's it. On your way, kid. Adios.
Wait a minute.
Kieran had covered maybe 3 miles when the subconscious processing going on in his brain suddenly delivered its conclusion that something wasn't right. He eased back the scooter's throttle, slowing the procession of sand and rocks through the scooter's headlight beam to a crawl, to free up more of his attention to pondering what. And then it came to him. This had shown every sign of being a professionally planned and executed operation. The people staging it might be crude in some ways, but they weren't dumb. Professionals would have made sure to leave the crawler and come away from the hijack with fresh air bottles, or at least bottles full enough to get them where they wanted to go. So the Mocha had never been heading for Quintus. Why, then, had Sandman said it was? The only reason could be for Kieran's benefit. It had been set up to feed Kieran false information, which he was now supposed to take back and report, sending everyone who would be searching off on wrong trails all over Elysium. While the hijackers did... what? The scooter came to a halt as Kieran followed the thread farther. Already his blood was rising again, this time not only from the humiliation of being disarmed and made a hostage, but from being taken for a fool and used as a dupe as well. If the Mocha wasn't going to Quintus, then in all probability, the destination it had been heading for was right here. To do whatever was due to happen next, while Kieran was purring his way sedately on a jaunt across the desert. Why would the hijackers waste any of that time going somewhere else now? And he surely hadn't seen or heard any sign of the ship taking off since he'd set out. So, something more was detaining them. His best guess was still that it was rendezvousing to transfer its cargo to some other craft. Kieran turned off the headlamp, eased the scooter into motion again, and U-turned between the dunes to set off back the way he had come. He could manage without the lamp now anyway. Phobos was rising. On a clear night, it could appear 300 times brighter than Venus seen from Earth. And even with the residual dust from the storm, he was easily able to follow his own tracks. He wasn't sure what he intended doing. Get access to a radio? Disable the craft somehow? Cause some kind of mischief? But he was mad and had a score to settle. Thank you for listening to part one of Jailhouse Rock by James P. Hogan, narrated by Rick Stringer, with the voices of Will Hoffecker, Phil Rossi, Jan Dalton, Jack Ward, Lonnie Ezel, Karen O'Carroll, Neil Stringer, and Nobilis. We will have more information about them on our MySpace and LiveJournal pages. To find out more about Variant Frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like Variant Frequencies, tell your friends about us. Thank you from the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Ann Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
The past never dies. It only sleeps. In a solitary station on the fringe of known space, the past is beginning to stir. And when it wakes,
Crescent Station will be as the belly of the beast.
You call your father, and you tell him there's something very wrong with this ship. Panic spoke up full now, and it said, "Scream for your life, bitch!" So Marissa screamed. We can't save her. We were wrong. We have to leave.
Crescent, a podcast novel by Phil Rossi. For more information, please visit www.crescentstation.net.
Some places are far darker than deep space.
Crescent is waking, my boy. Pray, sleep with the light on and one eye open. At least, until you get used to its creaks and groans.
Hello? Anybody there?
You know we are.
Who are you?
We've always been there, listening.
Who are you? What do you want?
You've heard of the Society.
The Society?
The Sonic Society. I know you know.
No. No. This is crazy. I'm gonna hang up.
We'll be here, Andrew. We never really left.
No one makes radio plays anymore.
We do. Our numbers are legion. We're growing every day. And we're waiting for you.
For me?
We're waiting for you to join us, Andrew.
Join you?
We're all over the world.
But why?
Because radio drama lives.
www.sonicsociety.org.
In a broken world where magic has been outlawed, one family rules it all.
He did this! He killed my baby!
One woman cursed with magic.
What have I done?
Becomes the pawn in a game of thrones that will tear the world apart.
Who is the woman you're so urgent to find?
Her mother.
You will kill her.
Of course, ma'am.
Do you think he knows?
When we find the woman, she will destroy him for us.
When her daughter is stolen, she wants only one thing: to get her back. But that all changes when she finds her.
What have they done to you?
Join me. Together we can stop the Overlord. The children will go free.
Never!
Daughter of the Sun, the epic fantasy novel by Lonnie Ezell. Find out more about the novel, the author, and the podcast at LonnieEzell.com.
3, 2, 1. Blast off.
Why Philip K. Dick hit the madness years? Come over to the Starship Sofa.
You want to find out why it took us 3 episodes and drove us mad? Then you can also check it out.
Find out why Alfred Bester was the man who bridged the gap between the pulp fiction and
New Wave.
And if you're ever interested in the top female in science fiction, welcome aboard. If your cup of tea is science fiction classic films, we have them here. Dark Star, Capricorn 1. And all cyberpunk enthusiasts out there, John Brummer was your leader. Come over and find out all about him on the Starship Sofa. We are the Pete and Dud of the science fiction world. Welcome to the Starship Sofa.
I'd just like to point out that we are not Ant and Dec, we are not Pete and Dud, we're not Derek and Clive. That's just what people have sent to us in email. www.starshipsofa.com.
Shuttle set for launch. Airlock will be opened in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, honey. Feel like getting in the mood?
Well, I think I have just the thing.
Doesn't do it for me.
I woke up this morning. I had a scone and a large house blend.
Oh, come on. Here.
Hello, and welcome to Nobilis Erotica, a podcast of erotic short stories, serials, and excerpts. This podcast is intended for mature audiences only.